First, we have the week's top stories from Physicians First Watch, read by its editor, Amy Herman. And then we have an interview. It's on hotspotting. Stay tuned. Here's the news.
Hi, everyone. First, a study finds that men who undergo prostatectomy for localized prostate cancer face higher risk for some functional deficits 5 years later compared with men who receive other treatments. In particular, the procedure was linked to more urinary incontinence and sexual dysfunction at 5 years. Next, researchers report that in adults with diabetes, treatment with SGLT2 inhibitors may confer lower risk for gout than treatment with GLP-1 receptor agonists. The finding is based on an analysis of some 240,000 patients who were prescribed either drug class. The researchers note that SGLT2 inhibitors lower uric acid levels. Elsewhere, the CDC reports that influenza B infections make up about half of flu-related hospitalizations so far this season. Influenza B can cause severe illness in children. It usually emerges later in the flu season. Next up, men seeking treatment for overactive bladder may want to start with behavioral strategies like pelvic floor exercises. In a randomized trial, men who received behavioral strategies alone or combined with medication saw similar reductions in the frequency of voiding, while those who took medications alone did not do as well. And finally, the World Health Organization reports that a novel coronavirus appears to be responsible for the pneumonia outbreak in Wuhan City, China. Over 40 people have become sick so far. There's no evidence of sustained person-to-person transmission, but limited transmission is possible. And that's it for this week. Stick around for Joe Elia's latest clinical conversation.
One approach to lowering healthcare costs and readmission rates is a more careful post-discharge planning, especially among so-called super-utilizers or frequent flyers. A strategy that has received much attention comes from the Camden, New Jersey Coalition of Healthcare Providers. Called the Camden Core Model, it identifies patients having medically and socially complex conditions and gets them access to home health visits, help with making and getting to appointments, and other resources. The approach is called hotspotting. A group of analysts from MIT and the National Bureau of Economic Research, with the cooperation of the Camden Coalition, decided to submit the Camden Core to a randomized controlled trial to see whether it lowered readmission rates. The results were surprising. The coalition's approach seemed no better than usual care. Here to discuss the findings just published in the New England Journal of Medicine is the study's senior author, Professor Joseph Doyle. Professor Doyle is the Irwin H. Schell Professor of Management and Applied Economics at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Professor Doyle.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Can you tell us briefly how you went about setting up the trial?
Sure. So, you know, this program has received a lot of attention, and we were really curious to see if it worked. It treats not only the clinical needs of patients, but their social needs as well. And as economists, we're particularly interested in whether these type of poverty alleviation programs can improve health in ways that can make everyone better off, and including potentially lowering healthcare costs. So, because of all the attention that it received, this Dr. Jeff Brenner, who was sort of the generator of the idea, he was interested in testing whether the program worked. And he partnered with MIT as sort of an honest broker, where we helped have sort of an arm's length view of what the program did. We went about recruiting patients for the trial in the same way they recruit patients for the program. But then instead of entering the program after that recruitment, they entered the study. And because they didn't have enough capacity to treat everyone who was eligible, this set up the possibility of randomizing who would get access to the program and who would not. So they still treated the same number of people, but then we had this really rigorous way to test whether the program reduced healthcare costs.
Okay. And all the participants, whether they were assigned to the Camden Core model of care or to usual care, they were all super utilizers, right, from Camden?
That's right.
And among these super utilizers were people with drug habits, people who were homeless, people on polypharmacy with mental health diagnoses. So this was a very stressed and disadvantaged group of people.
That's absolutely right. And compared to the literature, this is a particularly complex population. You'll see if you look at the paper that about 63% of the patients in the control group were readmitted to the hospital within 6 months of starting the trial. And the previous literature, those numbers were about half of that. So when we talk about hotspotting, this is truly hotspotting. We're looking for those superutilizers.
Yeah. And the introduction to your paper shows that the coalition's approach hadn't been subjected to a serious analysis previously. I mean, the implication as I was reading through the introduction was that fewer than 200 patients had been participants in a randomized trial of, is this thing really working or not?
Oh, but a few things there. So the program is multifaceted, and many of those facets have been looked at in previous randomized evaluations, and maybe even similar type of programs have been looked at for different populations. So older, less complex, to be honest, patients mm-hmm. have been looked at in other by other researchers. What hadn't been subject to a randomized trial was this flagship program in Camden mm-hmm. that really went to the edges of this hotspotting, looking at particularly complex patients. And we, all of us, including people, the leaders in Camden, really wanted to see if this type of program could work for that type of group.
You mentioned that one of the dangers of selecting such a group of very sick people at a moment in time when they've been admitted within 6 months of a previous admission and with all the problems that this group had is that over time they will show a regression to the mean. Can you explain that a bit?
Sure. So there are many processes that show reversion to the mean where you see a big increase in a negative outcome, let's say, but then that would naturally tend to fall back toward the mean. If it's sort of things are supposed to be going at a steady pace, then you might get unlucky and you see a run up and a negative outcome. You're likely to go back toward the mean. That's called reversion to the mean. And here, if a superutilizer program, if you're starting out looking for people who might have gotten unlucky a few times, they're sort of due to go back to the mean no matter what. So that's where it really is important to have a rigorous control group that we can then track to see if outcomes improve relative to the control group as opposed to just relative to the pre-period. Because we show in the paper that if you did a pre-post analysis of people who joined the program, you would see dramatic declines in utilization after joining the program. But we see the same dramatic declines in the randomized control group, just demonstrating the importance of that random assignment to get the treatment effects. And at MIT, I work with the Jamil Poverty Action Lab and our Health Systems Initiative, both of which have resources where we conduct large-scale randomized evaluations for exactly that purpose, to get the sort of the strongest evidence for what works and what doesn't in this realm.
Yeah, so the fact that you had a control group was very important. You could, I guess if you just looked at the results and you saw a kind of regression to the mean in the people who are getting the core treatment, you would say, oh, this is really working well. But with a control group, you're saying, okay, so now if they weren't getting this, how well are they doing? And speaking of that, primary outcome that you were looking for was the readmission rate within 6 months of enrollment in the program. And that readmission rate was almost identical. It was about 62% in both groups. And did you find that surprising or?
Well, going in, I thought that this program had a real chance to reduce hospitalization. The goal of the program was to, maybe we should describe the program a bit more, but they have a team of about 10 people who would spend on average 90 days with the superutilizers by attending their appointments with them, getting them signed up for social services, really trying to get their life back on track. And it has a real logic to it that for people with these complex needs, they could really use that type of concierge type service to help them navigate the healthcare system. And I definitely thought that it may reduce utilization. And one of the goals was for payers to get evidence that payers would pay attention to. Mm-hmm. If we found that it really reduced utilization, we thought that would pave the way toward more interest among payers for paying for these types of programs that address not only the clinical but also the social needs of patients. And I still believe that that logic is true. We just have to figure out how best to go about it. When we hear from Dr. Brenner in recent days, but also after the results were known, my reading of his take on it is that they've developed this wonderful program that would help people navigate a healthcare system, but the healthcare system really wasn't equipped to handle patients with such complex needs. And so there might be a need for greater investments in ambulatory ICUs or other types of ways that we could treat patients with such complex needs that might, again, have a return on investment that the payers are looking for. But in the end, improving the lives of the patients is really the key thing that we're interested in.
Yeah, the coalition put out a news release, I think it was yesterday, saying that the positive thing was that the patients in the coalition arm had a greater registration in social programs than the control group did. So in other words, it was at least successful in getting people to some social resources, if not improving their health.
Yeah, one of the things I'd like to tout about the research was we used administrative data, which dramatically lowers the cost of running these types of randomized evaluations. And one of the data sets that we used was we linked the subjects to public aid data in the state of New Jersey. And we found that for food stamps or this SNAP benefits, about a 10% improvement among those that were in the treatment group versus the control group, which, you know, makes sense because that's exactly the type of thing that we expect the coalition to do for people who are eligible but not receiving food stamps to help them sign up for such programs. So in part, it's nice to be able to show that we find an effect that you definitely expect to be there. Unfortunately, we don't find the effect on the hospitalization outcomes, but we did find it for that, what I would call one of the mechanisms by which we thought that it might work, which is getting people signed up for food stamps.
And one of the, there are a couple of things that you pointed out that may have made it difficult for it to succeed in Camden. It's the high rate of homelessness and the often difficult access to telephones in that patient group. And so it would be difficult to get in touch with those patients and not having a place where they could be located physically would also complicate things, wouldn't it?
That does, yeah. And so they do have a program that's been growing over time to get people who are housing unstable or homeless into housing. And there have been a few randomized evaluations of the what's called the housing first model, where you just get people in housing so then you can start to address their other needs, including being able to reach them to address those needs.
Yeah,
with the really promising results. So I really see that there's still a lot more research to be done there, but that's a really promising avenue to get improve the lives of people and get them healthier by getting them off the street or more housing secure.
Now, what are the lessons that you'd like other clinicians and health planners to take from your work?
Well, I mean, first, as a researcher, this idea that we need randomized evaluations to really test to see what's working and what's not is a way that we can stop chasing our tail. There are a lot of programs that sound good and that we really hope that they work, and then you look at a pre-post analysis and it looks like it works. That makes us feel good, but honestly, payers are less likely to believe those types of results because they're the ones who really want to see if it actually worked as opposed to sounds like it should work and feels good to think that it did. So more support for randomized evaluations of healthcare delivery, more on par with what we see for healthcare devices and drugs, would be something that the team here at MIT are really pushing for. And this gives a nice example, very high profile example of a program that sounds like it should work, but when you have the right control group, you see whether it actually does or not. The second thing is, I don't think we're done thinking about whether they're super utilizers or the need to address what has popularly known as social determinants of health. Medicare Advantage plans, for example, this year will be able to start paying for programs that address the social determinants like nutrition needs, transportation needs, housing needs. And there's a real thirst for what works and what doesn't in terms of that space. That's something that I encourage us all to think about. Where can we invest in that for prevention? And then hopefully get the support to do these randomized evaluations to see what works and what doesn't.
I want to thank you very much for speaking about your work with me today, Professor Doyle.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was our 248th episode. All may be found free at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch and the NEJM Group. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly, and I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.